Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 14, Text 42, Translation and Commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
Nangasya vangsho rajar sher
Nangasya vangsho rajar sher
Esha sangsthatam arhati
Esha sangsthatam arhati
Amogha virya hinripa
Amogha virya hinripa
Vangshe smin keshava shraya
Translation, the sages decided that the descendants of the family of the saintly King Anga should not be stopped, for in this family the seaman was very powerful, and the children were prone to become devotees of the Lord. Purport. The purity of hereditary succession is called Amogha Virya. The pious seminal succession in the twice-born families of the Brahmanas and Kshatriyas especially, as well as in the families of Vaishyas also, must be kept very pure by the observation of the purificatory processes beginning with Garbhadhan Sanskara, which is observed before conceiving a child. Unless this purificatory process is strictly observed, especially by the Brahmanas, the family descendants become impure and gradually sinful activities become visible in the family. Maharaj Anga was very pure because of the purification of semen in the family of Maharaj Dhruva. However, his semen became contaminated in association with his wife Sunita, who happened to be the daughter of death personified. Because of this polluted semen, King Vena was produced. This was a catastrophe in the family of Dhruva Maharaj. All the saintly persons and sages considered this point, and they decided to take action in this matter as described in the following verses. Among the many points we can understand from this verse and Srila Prabhupada's commentary on it is one important point of the functioning of Vedic polity, that the sages, Brahmanas, they took important decisions by consensus or by after consulting among each other. It might not be exactly by consensus as we understand it. In the modern age, the details of this are not given. In the modern age, it's considered everyone has a vote and everyone has equal rights. In Vedic culture, the Brahmana, the kings would have an assembly of ministers, which means Brahmanas, trained persons. And the ministers would be, the king would consult the ministers for important decisions. Here we see there's no king. And it doesn't specifically say that the ex-ministers of the king were assembling, but the Brahmanas. Not all Brahmanas are ministers by any means. But they're all concerned with the smooth running of society. Even to perform their own activities as Brahmanas, what to speak of the rest of the society, they require that there be a strong king and a pious king. Otherwise their own brahminical pursuits become disturbed And we see that in the present age. One of the many reasons, or one of the many factors, in the decline or almost total ceasing of the Brahmana class as it was traditionally, one major factor is that there are no pious kings to support them. Rather, this dasyu, that word is used in the Bhagavatam for the kings in Kali Yuga. Dasyu means thief, armed robber, not just someone who sneaks up and snatches something when you're not looking, but armed robbers. So they've taken all the properties away from the brahmanas, and they've destroyed the culture in which brahmanas can live and work. So brahmanas, they've become what they are today, non-brahmanas. So the sages, they consulted among themselves, and I said it may not be exactly consensus as we conceive of it at the present time. In modern age there's democracy, one man, one vote. That's what it used to be. Now it's one person, one vote. It used to be that women didn't have any vote. And actually an original democracy in Greece, the cradle of Western non-civilization, it was every citizen had a vote, and not everyone was a citizen, because there were slaves also. It's not, nowadays we think that a citizen means someone who lives in a country, is born in a country, has citizenship, but previously not everyone had that right. They were property. Some of them were property of others as slaves, and others were not slaves, but they weren't citizens either. They didn't have a voting right. So the brahmanas, their consensus, yeah, they would get together and discuss and then come to a decision. But they weren't actually ruling society. It's not that the brahmanas had an oligarchy, they would give advice, and in severe situations, well, they themselves removed the king, the previous king, because he was so bad. They were able to do that. But generally they had an advisory role, and it was expected that the king, after taking their advice, would follow it. So they were actually very powerful in that sense. And the king also had to have enough discernment to appoint good ministers, although it would usually come down in a family line that when the outgoing king died, that's how he was outgoing, he would remain king up until death, or he might in old age appoint a prince regent to rule, as Dasharath desired to do with Lord Rama. So the ministers would remain the same. It's not that they'd have a new cabinet and be a total change each time, just a very stable system. So actually the brahmanas, they were very powerful. And yeah, I was saying it's not exactly consensus, because even among the brahmanas, it's not that they'd all discuss and then they take a vote and then it's 7-6, okay, passed. It might... But they would discuss, and generally even among the brahmanas, some would be considered more senior, more learned, more wise, and it's not legislated like that. A lot of the culture went along by understanding. Just like in Britain, they don't have a constitution. It runs according to understanding of certain principles. So, the elder, the one who's considered, he might be called the prime minister in modern language, with Mukhyamantri, I guess it means the same thing. And then he would convey the message of the brahmanas to the king. If the discussion wasn't in an open assembly with the king, then they could discuss among themselves and come back, or a deputation might go to offer their opinion to him like that. Because there could be very different opinions on what to do. And someone has to make a decision. Just like, just to give an example, within our society, ISKCON at the present time, there's among many, many various issues which are always going on, there's some informal movement or some pressure being brought to the GBC body to enact the Srila Prabhupada's direction of management, which Srila Prabhupada wrote down in 1974 and was never implemented. So it's just like people say, well, you know, you can make some compromise on certain issues and give, you know, do a little bit of this or a little bit of that. But either in this instance, you either implement it or you don't. So there may not be give and take or some kind of mutual rapprochement, but it may be that they have to decide one way or the other. And if you decide one way, then certain people will be happy with that and others will be unhappy. And if you decide another way, then the other, just like this Telangana issue, it's insolvable as long as these people insist that there should be Telangana should be separated from Andhra Pradesh. Possibly we could make. Anyway, I'm just making that. I don't want to get into that, but some issues, often issues are very complex, and then it requires someone to give a decision, just like, whereas in the modern age, it's decided, well, everyone voted, and then it came out, you know, that someone got more votes than the other. Or actually, in democracy, it often works out the person who takes charge, according to the legal process, gets less votes, as happened with George Bush Jr. He had less votes, but according to the system that was set up, that he was made the President of the United States of America, because that was the system. It doesn't exactly work out that the person who gets the most votes gets the post, or that the decision is made according to the most votes. So, well, that's another discussion. And there's a discussion of proportional representation, but it's so complicated. So, what's the perfect system? What is the perfect system for governing this material world? Any suggestions? What do you think? Make Savyasachi the dictator for the whole world? Makes any suggestions? What about Varnashram? Enlightened monarchy. So Varnashram is perfect system. Well, we could say it's perfect, but it's for regulating imperfection. So it can never be completely perfect, because it's always subject to the imperfections of the people taking part in it. But we can say it's the best system because it's given by Krishna. Not just because Krishna is who he is and what he does is always the best, but in this material world, whatever the system is, it can be misused, as happened with the Varnashram system, which is a major factor in why it's broken down. But it's the best system. And there are so many factors which are required to uphold it, just like the Garbhadhan Garbhadhan Sanskara is required for the upper castes, as Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur pointed out in his Brahmana O Vaishnava, that's the short name, for he pointed out that probably in most of the families that consider themselves orthodox Brahmana families, the Garbhadhan Sanskara has not been, if there's one break or if it's not performed properly at any time in the whole history of the family, then the whole family is converted to Shudras according to the principle of Varnashram, or their whole understanding, not the principle, according to the whole understanding of Varnashram. And so probably most of these people who are calling themselves Brahmanas are not Brahmanas anyway, even according to their own consideration. So that's one point. And then another point is in the training from the very beginning, the culture. It's said that the mother is the first guru because she teaches all the Vedic cultural usages such that Prabhupada had to teach his disciples, such as not using toilet paper after you pass stool, and not, you know, you use very cultured in the West, you pass stool, wipe your backside with toilet paper and pull up your pants and you're ready to go. Oh, remember to wash your hands. If you do that, that's you know, very hygienic. So Prabhupada had to teach that with your left hand, you know. But normally that was done by the mother. And the mother also, not just that, but so many things, offering respect and to others, and it tells him stories from Ramayana and all this kind of thing. So the first guru is the mother. In the modern age or outside the Vedic culture, I wonder if the mother can be called a guru, because she doesn't. Guru means Shastra Upadeshta. That's the definition given in Amar Kosh. So if she doesn't teach according to Shastra, then is she a guru or guruvi? Now there's a movement, women should be gurus. Great, I'm all for it. You know, they should have children and teach their children and be the first. That's what they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be gurus like that. So let them be gurus, yes. Instead of not having children and or having more husbands than they have children, without not like Draupadi either. And not being gurus because they don't know what's in Shastra or what to teach. So, the Vedic system, then we're talking about the sages, that any important decision, even, you see, there may be, we're talking about the most senior and wise Brahmana would give the final decision, but that after consult, even he would consult with others. It's not just that, okay, well, you know, I know what's going on, so okay, here's the understanding, here's what should be done. But it's understood that life is very complex, and this is one of the principal messages of Mahabharata. The Mahabharata can be, in many ways, can be understood as a manual of how to live in this world according to Shastra. Giving practical examples. And one of the main points that comes out is that it can be often very difficult to understand what is the correct thing to do. Because always there'll be the nature of this world is that everything doesn't run smoothly as we expect it to, and Shastric principles, they often come into conflict in any situation. That famous story of which I've told so many times, you probably all fall asleep if I try to tell it again. Of the that woke you up. That The Brahmana who told a lie, he was committed to the principle of never speaking anything but the truth, and as a result went to hell, because he didn't know the principles of dharma. That in this case, the principle of never telling a lie, which is a very good practice, came into conflict with the principle of giving protection to a person who required it, and in that case he should have lied, and he didn't. So he went to hell for being truthful in the wrong... His truthfulness, when misapplied, made him go to hell, or caused him to go to hell. So like that, throughout the Mahabharata, Drona has to be killed. How to kill? Well, he himself told to Yudhishthira before the battle, how can we kill you? Yudhishthira asked. It's a funny question to ask your guru, but it's not the normal question you'd ask your guru. Just tell me, how can I kill you? So you have to ask your guru. Anything difficult to do, you have to ask your guru, and you have to perform your duty under the guidance of your guru. So Yudhishthira's duty was to fight and kill the enemy. So he asked his guru, but his guru was the enemy. So Drona said, well, you can't kill me, unless Ashwatthama is killed. And then he asked Ashwatthama, how can you be killed? Cannot. I'll be alive. When this battle's over, I'm going to be alive. You're not going to kill me. Which was actually a fact. And he's still alive. Somewhere. In Vrindavan, I believe it said. Wandering around incognito. So Drona has to be killed. He can't be killed unless Ashwatthama is killed. If he's not killed, then we're all killed. And if we're all killed, then our purpose is undone. So what to do? Kill Ashwatthama, the elephant. He's also Ashwatthama, and fooled Drona in this way. So it required to be done. So it just goes to it's not very good. And up to this day, people are blaming Krishna for that. But Krishna demonstrated. Krishna, he could have just by his wish, he could have, relaxed on the chariot, ate a few grapes and said, okay, you all die. No need for all this battle. But he didn't. He got right into it. He took the arrows were going in his body and dust covering his own. And he got fully involved in it. In the battle. So Krishna demonstrated by all this, so many incidents like this, or incidences, as they say in Indian English, when they mean, should say incidents. In so many incidents like this throughout the Mahabharata, we find that religious principles, what should be done, they come into conflict. That what should be done in a certain circumstance? You can't act in a way, circumstances are such that you cannot act in such a way that you follow all the principles of Shastra. You have to break, to follow one, you have to break another. So life can be very complex. And even then, a learned sage, he might consult with others. But then he would take the final decision. And it might not be just that it's his right, but that, why is it always him? But it's also his responsibility. He has to, at the end of the discussion, he has to take a decision that we'll advise the king in this way. Well, there was no king in this way, in this time. So it's privilege. Sometimes people say, oh, why does this person have this privilege and that privilege? But with privilege always comes responsibility. And the responsibility is not always... often it's not easy to discharge. But still it has to be discharged. And that's the meaning of responsibility. That you perform, that's what one of the main messages of Krishna to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, that you have to discharge your duty. You have to take the responsibility. You can't be negligent. You can't just leave the battle and just, you know, well, I don't like this battle, so, you know, Hari Bol, see you all later. Have a good fight. Tell me what happened. Of course, Balaram did that, but that was, his case was different. He wasn't directly involved as Arjuna was. So he had to, the chief brahmana had to take responsibility and assist. It's different to the modern age, in which everyone, they'll discuss and then everyone will form their own opinion based on the discussion, or maybe they not based on the discussion, maybe they've already made up their mind before they started or whatever, but at the end of discussing the issue, then everyone votes. They make a proposal. Okay, I think we should do like this. What do you think? Seconded. Okay. Any other proposal? All right, take a vote. And whatever the vote is, that stands. But among the sages, then it would be that, all right, everyone discusses. And then the senior, they would, after hearing everything, just like, something like a judge in the court. You say, okay, I've heard this and I've heard that, and all right, this is my decision. And then everyone, all right, okay, we accept that. Because he's supposed to have a deeper insight into all the issues. And in an important case, the judge will also explain his verdict. And he'll explain if he, especially if he gives a heavy punishment, or maybe if he gives a punishment that's much lighter than might have been expected, he'll explain why. So, this is the culture. It's very, it's an enlightened culture, actually, but it's probably not possible in the modern age because people are so unenlightened. It's not just that the culture is different and where people are used to having equal votes, but just people are so stupid that they can't understand pravritting cha nivritting cha janana vidura suraha. They can't understand what's proper and what's not proper. People are extremely dull-headed. And even if they are so-called intelligent, as we see, there's quite a common t-shirt that I was born intelligent, but then I got an education. It's like the education makes you stupid. And it makes you particularly, the modern educational system makes you particularly stupid because you actually think that you're becoming more intelligent while you're going through it, but actually you become more stupid. It's just like in this Dawkins, the God Delusion book, he's making the point that in America and England and all these countries, not in England, because more or less everyone's an atheist, but the atheists, they're mostly drawn from the higher, the more educated sections of society. And the higher the level of education, the more percentage of atheists. So he wants to show that, you see, it's the more intelligent people, they're atheists. But he overlooks the fact that the educational system is atheistic in itself, and that it's therefore inherently stupid. So the more educated you get, the more stupid you become. And that it's actually good evidence that atheism is for the more stupid people.
And even that is wrong.
And even that, he was misquoting. He accuses the creationists of being mendacious or misleading. In this context, I guess it means lying, but he himself, he misquoted. Well, it's with, you know, statistics. What can you do? So, all these cultural usages, people would protest in the modern age. This is not fair. This is not right. Why should a few people decide the fate of everybody else? Everyone should have their voice. Everyone should have a say, but it's actually a very stupid idea, if anyone's got any brain left to think about it, that people who They don't know the issues. They're not trained in good character. They don't know what the purpose of life is. And then why should they decide how society should be run? It's andha parampara nyai, the blind leading the blind. So actually the Vedic system is an excellent, the best system, but how can we convince people of that? Well, I guess we ourselves should exemplify among ourselves, among the society of Vaishnavas, how well we work, how well we work together, how good character is inherent in those who take to the process of Krishna consciousness, but it's often very difficult to, it seems difficult to bring people to a better standard of culture and character. It often seems very difficult to do that. So we're still very, although it might be considered that our devotees are more mature than when we first joined, than when Prabhupada started this movement in the 1960s, but in many ways we still have a long, long way to go to come to the standard in which Srila Prabhupada suggested that by democracy, people, on seeing the behavior of the devotees, they'd vote for Krishna conscious leaders. Well, we're still a long, long way from that. It just seems like a dream at the present time. It's from the external point of view, or what we might in a worldly sense call the realistic point of view, our movement is just very small and insignificant, and no one has, even someone might think this art, they might ask this, the art of living, or previously this transcendental meditation guy, they might ask them for, someone might think to ask them about state polity or methods of government or decisions to be made. They might, not very likely, but they might, but they don't, no one would think of asking. Who would they ask anyway? I mean, who is the leader in this movement? It's difficult to see. Everyone's the same. It's all one. In these principles of culture, if they're adhered to, they actually help to make one a better person. It's not that just by being in the Vedic culture one is a saintly person, because in many ways Ravana, for instance, was following Vedic culture. I mean, there was one, at least one major defect, that he used to steal people's wives, which isn't allowed, not supposed to be allowed. But otherwise, you see, his son Indrajit was expert in performing yajñas. He was expert brahmana. He had brahma teja, brahma shakti. By chanting the mantras, he got the result, but he misused that. So it's not necessarily just that by following Vedic culture one becomes saintly, or even one may become saintly in character apparently, but have a most demonic understanding, just like the Shankaracharya line. They're very strong on culture, on Vedic culture, but their conclusion is demonic. But if Vedic culture is wedded with the conclusion of Vedic culture, namely Krishna consciousness, then these two put together are very powerful for reforming the character. If one is Krishna conscious or attempts to be Krishna conscious without Vedic culture, well, actually it will be very difficult to be Krishna conscious anyway, because the Vedic culture is meant for and based on Krishna consciousness. But we see that Especially in the early days of the movement, the devotees had very little idea of saintly behavior. And even now, many devotees in the West especially, they have very little idea of Vedic culture, but they may be very sincere devotees and very committed to Krishna consciousness. But then, due to lack of understanding of the principles of Krishna consciousness, they may support or consider correct various cultural usages which are actually opposed to Vedic culture and detrimental to the overall development of human society, just like feminism, for example. The idea that men and women's social roles should be more or less the same. Or, as I was giving the example, one may be very cultured. Still today we can meet. Still today, hear me, in this year of the good Lord, 2010, in the month of January, how many years more will it go on that we'll find people, actual brahmanas, in the family tradition? There are still some Vaishnav, non-Vaishnav, there are still some. But for lack of the non-Vaishnavas, they have very good culture, but for lack of Krishna consciousness, it doesn't really help them very much. Dharma svanushtita pungsa vishvaksena katasuya not padiyad yadiratim shrama eva hi kevalam. That they may be very cultured, but because they're not Krishna conscious, they're not attempting to be Krishna conscious, then we can say, well, it's an activity that they perform. That's all. Yep. Shrama eva hi kevalam, especially the karma kandis. I mean, they do a lot of shram. They have to. It's a lot of work following karma kanda, all the different rituals to follow. When it says shrama eva hi kevalam, it could refer to people carrying heavy weights on their backs, literally, but more likely to refer to, or more likely to be understood as referring to ritualistic followers of the Vedic culture, who they perform many, so many things to follow, so many rituals, but ultimately what's the use if you don't have a taste for understanding Krishna? But if the two are put, if the Krishna consciousness with pure Vedic culture, if the two are put together in a person, then it becomes a very powerful combination. But actually, it's not very possible that individuals can do so, because culture means group. Culture is within a group. You can't say that one person's culture. It means Tamil culture or Tamil Brahmin culture, Tamil Brahmin Smarta culture. It means groups of people. There may be subgroups within that. So, it's quite a job to even consider how to set this all up. Again, Srila Prabhupada's idea of the farm community or the rural community gives more of a possibility of that. It's very difficult to set up Vedic culture in the middle of completely hedonistic culture, which even in India, which is the culture is so much spoiled in practically in one generation. Which gives some hope that maybe it could be revived in one generation also, by if the leaders of society take it up and promote it, it may be possible also. Of course, in Kali Yuga, it seems that by the influence of Kali, that bad things, they they take effect more easily. It's more easy to degrade than to retrograde or to come back to the proper point. But then Krishna is more powerful than Kali. So if there's strong chanting of the holy names, strong desire to serve Krishna, coupled with the endeavor to revive Vedic culture with a proper understanding of what their culture is, and again, it's very complex how to apply it in the modern age. So it all requires a lot of intelligence, a lot of prayer, a lot of mercy from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and all the devotees. Srila Prabhupada wanted this. So we have a great task ahead, but it's a glorious task and it's worth endeavoring for, even though it seems very difficult how Krishna consciousness can be established in the world. It seems very difficult to do, but it's possible. Sri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadama Hyam Dadati Srapadantikam. Rupa Goswami established Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's heart's desire. He established it. He established what it was. Srila Prabhupada also established Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's heart's desire in a very practical way. I mean, not just establishing what the principle is, but the enactment of that also. And that's an ongoing process establishing Krishna. Still, Krishna consciousness has to be established much more firmly and much more widely in the world. Now our movements, we can say it's established. It's there, it's going on. It doesn't look like it's going to fade away very soon. But to establish it, the next level of actually being accepted as, at least as a widely accepted as an alternative. And then the next level is that it becomes the predominant culture in society. So there are levels of establishing Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's desire. Rupa Goswami at one level, and then all acharyas, their job is to establish in this. Gauriya Vaishnava acharyas, they become an acharya by establishing in the world, at least among one person they are an acharya to, or whoever their disciples are. They establish in the world the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Srila Prabhupada brought that mission as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu desired. That was his heart's desire to bring this movement all over the world. So that's done, and it's an ongoing job. We all have our part to play. Hare Krishna. Any question or comment about this, please?
Guru Maharaj, in ISKCON today, in NCC meeting or RGB or other meetings, the way the decision is by voting. This is what Srila Prabhupada...
Is the voting system what Prabhupada wanted? Yes, in the GBC? He wanted that. The system was they would take a vote and then it would come to Prabhupada. And then he would say yes or no. Mostly said yes, sometimes he would change the whole thing. Just like it was decided that all the women without husbands would have to leave the temples as GBC resolution, Prabhupada threw it out. Didn't accept it, for instance. Who should do that today? If anyone should do that, well, I don't see that Prabhupada, he didn't appoint one acharya who would be the final word on everything. He wanted the GBC to manage by a vote system. So you can say it's a compromise for the modern age. There's one conversation also in which Prabhupada said that in the modern age there has to be democracy. He was talking about something in New Vrindavan.
New Vrindavan, the discussion was going on about the schedules and who will be the president and who will be the...
Yeah. And that direction of management thing is also based on more democratic procedures than at the present time. Although I asked Hari Shauri Prabhu that why wasn't that implemented? even though Prabhupada said it should be implemented. And he said that, well, Prabhupada later changed his mind because he thought it would introduce too much politics. It means the GBC is has to be, every 3 years has to be changed. I don't think it mentions in there, but at another time Prabhupada wanted Tamil presidents to be, well, in the beginning it was by vote. The first time, it was in New York, where Brahmananda was the natural leader there. Everyone looked at him as the leader, and so Prabhupada said, okay, so we'll have a vote, and who will be the Tamil president? And I think it should be Brahmananda. Then everyone voted for Brahmananda. So, not surprisingly. So, yeah, that's coming up. So, would it create... See, there's quite a lot of discontent and within our movement, just in case you haven't noticed. And so there's this idea, well, we should change the system and vote GBCs every 3 years. And my opinion on this, for all it's worth, and I guess it makes absolutely no difference whatsoever, seeing as, you know, even if I was to say it directly to the GBC body, which probably wouldn't make any size bit of difference. They'd probably like it because it more or less supports the general stand not to implement the direction of management. But, my overall thought is that we shouldn't implement something just considering the present situation in the society. We have to think for the next 10,000 years. If we're saying there's this problem and that problem in ISKCON, therefore we should make this change, we shouldn't just make a change based on what's going on now, but we have to see for the whole future of the movement. It's a very immature, short-sighted policy to make changes that are going to affect the whole society for the whole future just based on some present observation, which was one of my objections to the giving women more rights in ISKCON and everything, because it was considered women had been mistreated. But we have to consider the overall situation, and we're supposed to be moving towards Varnashram. Anyway, this point with... So that's one point, and then another point is that, yeah, okay, there are problems within ISKCON, and you want to circulate the GBC, and it's considered the GBC isn't doing a very good job. All right, okay, accepted. But, on the other hand, there is stability in our society, which comes from a not changing... One of the reasons is that the GBC doesn't change, and one of the reasons that the movement is somehow or other in shape and still going on, notwithstanding all its problems, it means there is some stability, which if you're always changing everyone, then it becomes much less stable, and it's very difficult to enact long-term policies if you're always changing the leadership every 3 years. And definitely will create politics, and it'll be just so... There are pros and cons, but I don't see that it's just a given that we have to start voting everyone and change the system as it is now. So that's some thoughts, for all it's worth, which probably isn't very much, but anyway, there it is. Prabhupada's general principle was to, if there's any fault in any leader or fault, I mean, anything anyone does can be perceived by someone else as a fault. That's one thing. But if it's observed that there are problems, Prabhupada's general policy was to try to rectify rather than make a radical change. That was his general policy, as far as I can see. So, Hare Krishna, any other questions, comments? Yeah.
During Vedic times, and the higher...
One other point, just as you said Vedic times, I was also talking about it. It is a very... It's almost like a nebulous term, Vedic times or Vedic culture, because it's not that there was any one time when there was Vedic culture, and there are very various manifestations and It's not that you can say, but among ourselves, when we talk about Vedic culture, we're talking about what we consider it should be, maybe more than what it ever particularly was, because, like I say, there's Varnashram as a system for regulating imperfection. But yeah, we can say more or less during, as things were going on during the time of Lord Rama. But even that was a compromise. Having a king is a compromise. Varnashram is a compromise. In Satya Yuga, there's no need of organizing society because everyone's Paramahamsa, apart from Hiranyakashipu. Among the forest sages, there's anarchy. I mean, anarchy is the best system, actually. But then people have to be good enough to live non-exploitive. Vedic culture, practically, the Varnashram system is a compromise for people who are less than perfect. So, yeah. So we can talk about Vedic culture. I just want to make that point, that it's, you know, it's a very broad term. Yeah.
In the context of modern scholarship.
In the context of modern scholarship.
When they say Vedic times, they refer to.
They refer to what they consider to be the time when the Vedas were. Yeah, the Vedas were written down, and then later came the Puranas, and even the Vedas, and then later came the Upanishads, and anyway. Modern scholarship. Yeah, modern scholars have written many good books which can be well utilized by devotees. They're very good for fuel, making chapatis, and so we thank them for their contributions, and we can take them all and use it all, and you can all be used in Krishna's service. They can all get a lot of benefit. Okay, we'll finish there. Hare Krishna. All glories.